Just No. Sala Lungshin, Nantaburi, November 18th, 2007.
Genuine Dhamma talks don't come from a script. The teachings come out naturally and are being transmitted from heart to heart. If we practice meditation as we listen, the teachings that are appropriate for us to know at that time will be expounded to us. It is very different from book learning. With Dhamma, there is no need to listen intently, to think, to take notes or ask questions. We should practice now in a relaxed way as we listen. It is not important to be able to absorb all of the content, the words that are being said. It is hard to find much sense in what I say. I speak of the same things all the time, and yet amazingly, the same people keep coming to listen over and over. It is all about mindfulness. Mindfulness is the key, the all-important link in the chain that is missing from most other religions. Other religions have meditation and morality, as Buddhism does, but their scriptures lack the instructions on mindfulness, on watching and learning from one's own body and mind. It is a shame to overlook the opportunity to practice mindfulness after one has come into contact with Buddhist teachings. It is the only way to enlightenment, to a pure and free mind. Without it, the best we can do is to temporarily hold the mind in a state of peace, which cannot solve the problems that plague our minds. Mindfulness doesn't just mean that we know what is going on around us or that we do the right thing. It is deeper than that. Most of us are completely lost in the world of thinking and interpretation. We are thinking all day and thinking all night. Thinking while we sleep at night is called dreaming, of course. Whenever we are thinking, we forget about our body and our mind. We forget about the foundations of mindfulness. For example, if we want to perform a generous act, like helping a stranger or giving charity, the mind is in a state of virtue. But if we do not know that virtue has arisen, we are not mindful. We need to know what the body is doing or what is happening in the mind, not the content of the story that the mind is telling, not the voice in our heads. Why are the body and mind the foundations of mindfulness? Why do we need to know what is happening within the body and mind? Simply, so we can see the truth of body and mind. Usually, when meditators practice meditation, they are not interested in learning the truth of body and mind. They are essentially trying to control the body and mind. For example, we may try to sit in certain positions so that we will not experience pain. Or if we already feel pain, we may mull over how we should sit so that we can cope with it. In such cases, we are interested in getting past periods of pain, but not looking to see the truth of body and mind. We may try to determine the ideal way to sit so that we can be peaceful for longer periods of time, to be still and comfortable, possibly for days. When we do this, we are pretty much just interested in measures of control. It is the nature of the mind to think, to fabricate stories, to run from here to there, to be nice sometimes, mean others, happy sometimes, and unhappy other times. The mind moves to watch, to hear, to smell, to taste, to feel sensations, and also runs to think. It's always moving and changing, but the moment we think of meditation, we are looking for ways to make it still, to make it stop thinking. Many people ask how to stop the mind from thinking. The mind's function is to think. The mind is not a tree or a rock. Enlightened people think too. We are not practicing meditation so that we can make the mind abnormal or force it to no longer perform its function. We watch and know the foundations of mindfulness so that we can see the truth of body and mind. The truth of the body is that it is material. It is a physical mass of elements. We need mindfulness that can see the body objectively as just a material thing, like a robot that sits, moves, stands, with elements coming in and out through processes such as breathing, ingestion, and excretion. The body is not us or ours. We are using it, borrowing it from the world. We started by using our parents' elements. After birth, elements come in and out by our own eating, drinking, breathing, and excreting. Eventually, we die and give the elements back to the world. Watch the body well and see that it is not us. It is not a person or a being, but just a mass of elements. It is not a special mass either. It is a suffering one. Even just sitting, we experience pain. When young, it may be hard to notice, but as we get older, even sitting for just a moment is painful without even having to do anything. Some people, with all good intentions, wish that their meditation master will live 100 years. As Venerable Master Teit in Forest Monk Tradition said, those who wish someone to live 100 years have never felt what it is like to be old. The truth is that we are only really our strongest and healthiest until about age 35. After 35, our bodies really start to go downhill. But even youngsters can see that the body is suffering. Sit still for a long time without moving. We'll see that even just sitting gets quite painful, and we'll have to adjust to relieve the suffering. The body truly is a mass of suffering. Try to only breathe in without breathing out. We'll see quickly that we need to breathe out to relieve suffering. The same is true if we breathe only out. It is torturous. We will need the in-breath to relieve us. Even breathing is a process of repeatedly suffering and trying to relieve it. Suffering is oppressing the body and mind in everything that we do. If we watch the breath mindfully, or watch sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, with proper mindfulness, the body will be seen clearly as a physical mass of elements, moving about and invariably suffering. It will not be mistaken as being us or ours. Many of us would like to practice Vipassana meditation. However, for genuine Vipassana, we must see the body and mind as the three characteristics: impermanent, suffering, and not us. It is not yet Vipassana if we are just mindful of body and mind. Vipassana is seeing clearly, in an extraordinary way, that the body and mind exhibit the three characteristics. We do this repeatedly until we reach the first stage of enlightenment, stream entry, and clearly and profoundly know that the body and mind are not us. Watch the mind. See it never stays in the same state. Watch the body and see it is suffering. It is hard to see the body as changing since it appears to change slowly, but the mind is never the same, from day to day, from moment to moment. It changes each time it makes contact with a new stimulus. We see some guy and like him, and then we see some girl and dislike her. It is easy to see anicca, or impermanence. The mind is changing all the time. We can also see anatta, non-self, from watching the mind by seeing that we can't control it. The mind may become happy, but we can't order it to be happy or to stay happy in any real way. We can't prohibit unhappiness from arising. We can't order it away. We can't force the mind to be in a virtuous state either. The characteristic that the mind is beyond control and can't be forced into any state is called anatta. When we see impermanence, suffering, and non-self, then we see the truth of the body and mind. When we see the truth like this clearly, we become bored or disenchanted by the body and mind, by the world as we experience it. The world loses its allure, its flavor. We lose interest in going out to attain states and to achieve things. We start to see the ways of the world as meaningless, senseless, flavorless. Then, when different mental states arise, the mind will no longer move towards or grasp at them. Happiness arises, and we remain stable. The mind won't move anywhere. We won't try to keep the happiness alive or try to pursue more of it. When unhappiness arises, we don't run away from it. We don't try to stop it or protect ourselves from it. All this movement ends, and so we don't get involved in fabricating stories, becoming, or creating a personal existence. When our old stories about ourselves and the world fade, they are not replaced by new ones. This is all not so difficult. Actually, it is pretty easy. But when I was practicing, I thought it was hard for a long time, as many of us do. To be honest, getting to the point where it was easy was deadly. We have to die many times to get to where we stop becoming anything anymore. In a war, we die only once. In this game, we die over and over again for the mind to be mature enough and to be wise enough to completely wash away all of the ignorance, all of the greed, and all of the aversion that defile the mind. When the mind is finally free of the defilements, we will never be born again as a self in this life or any other. The reason we are never born again is because we clearly see the true nature of body and mind. To have the mindfulness to do this, we need to be aware of the body and mind. Those that practice a lot will see that usually we don't remember our bodies and minds. We know only the content of our thoughts. We are thinking all day long, knowing what we are thinking, but not knowing what the body and mind are doing. If we are not knowing the body and the mind, then we are not practicing in the foundations of mindfulness. If we don't have mindfulness of the body and mind, then we don't see the truth of them. If we don't see the truth of them, then we don't become disenchanted by them. Then we don't let go of our attachment to them. And if we don't let go of our attachment to them, we will never be liberated from suffering. Enlightenment will not be realized. At first we see there isn't a person. There isn't a being, a me, a you, or a them. We see the world as empty of selfhood. Self only arises out of thinking. We get lost in thinking, and then the false ideas that there are a me and a you appear. When we wake up out of the world of thinking, we see that a self doesn't really exist. It is easy once we understand, but difficult when we don't. When we don't, we become disgruntled and wonder what we should do to practice correctly. All meditators try to figure out what they should do to practice correctly, and when they do this, they are wanting something, wanting to do something. In the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha never taught us to do anything. But when we set out to practice, we always want to do. What should I do to meditate correctly? What should I do to be good? What should I do to enlighten? What should I do to be free? When the Buddha taught what to practice, he didn't use the word do. He said just know. Know the body. Know it is sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. If we know the breath, be mindful and know when the breath is short, that it is short. If it is long, that it is long. If it disappears, that it has disappeared. If the mind is happy, know it is happy. If it is unhappy, know it is unhappy. If it is neither happy nor unhappy, know it is neutral. If it is clinging, know it is clinging. If it is angry, then know. If it is worrying, then know. If it is restless, then know. If it is deluded, then know. The main verb is to know. But we don't want to know, do we? We want to do. We want to know what to do so that the mind will be this way or that way, according to our preferences. We act similarly with regards to the body as well. This word do is what makes us interfere with the natural workings of the body and mind. We then control the body and mind instead of seeing them in their true nature. Can we control them? We can only do so temporarily by samatha meditation. For example, if anger arises, we can concentrate on a mantra or the breath, send out loving kindness, or fix our attention on the anger until it goes away. Then when the anger disappears, we think we practiced successfully. We think we're so great. Can you see that instead of realizing the truth of non-self, we are inflating our sense of self? So don't try to control anything. Don't look for solutions of what to do. Anything we do is wrong. Once I was staying in a monastery in Surin province in the northeast of Thailand. As I got out of my hut in the morning, I noticed a nice tree with a chair beneath it, by a beautiful little pond. I thought to myself that this is where I would like to practice my meditation for the day. Then suddenly, a monk shouted from the other side of the pond, "Hey, Pramod, by wanting to practice, you're already in the wrong." How was I wrong? I was wrong because I wasn't aware of the thinking or the wanting. I wasn't knowing. The word know is the most important word in Buddhism. Buddha means the one who knows, the awakened one. When we forget about knowing, then we move away from the Buddhist religion. We move to a religion of self-control. Many religions have faith as the path. Others have love. If we are looking to have a Buddhist way of life, then we must be knowing and seeing the truth of body and mind. We are to just keep knowing and knowing. There isn't anybody here that can't know, right? Just knowing that you are not sure is already knowing, so anyone can know. You may have noticed that when you were listening and not thinking anything, there was no self-doubt. But as soon as you started to think, doubt arose in the mind. If we see that uncertainty has arisen and don't continue to entertain it with thinking, then the uncertainty won't have a cause for remaining, and it will fall away. We will see that each mental phenomenon or state arises out of cause, and when the cause is absent, the state too will disappear. Who else thinks that he or she cannot know? Has anyone here never been angry? Does anyone here not know what it is like to feel greed? Does anyone not know what a wandering mind is like? Does anyone not know worrying, feeling upset, happiness, sadness, or any of the emotional states? We all know these things. So whenever any of these states arise, just know that it has arisen. To see feelings in the right way is to see them as a sort of imposter, not identifying with them as ourselves. Anger or doubt are not us. They are not people or beings. No one sees them as people. So see them without giving them an identity, just as strangers coming in and then leaving. When there is a cause, they arise, and when there is no cause, they fall away. We keep learning, keep knowing, until we see there is really nothing to it. There is nothing to gain either. We don't learn Dhamma to obtain anything. Many masters have said that in enlightenment, we don't gain or lose anything. We don't gain anything because there is nothing in the world that an arahant, a fully enlightened being, attaches to. Even if we want to attain Nibbana, it will never happen. All wanting and attachment must be dropped, even with regards to Nibbana. We don't lose anything in enlightenment because we never had anything to begin with. The body is just elements that we are borrowing from the world. The mind just arises out of its own causes and falls away when they are gone. It does this over and over again with each mental phenomenon. There is no gain or loss. If we could say anything is gained, it is an understanding. We see things in their true nature. This is what arises from practicing in the four foundations of mindfulness: the body, feelings, mind, and natural processes. We see the four noble truths that the Buddha taught: suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. If we can see these truths clearly, then we can end the cycle of birth and death and end suffering once and for all. When we read the noble truths, it seems easy to understand that the body and mind are suffering, but to actually see this in our own experience is just about the hardest thing we can do. Usually, all we see is that the body is suffering sometimes and content others, and the mind also oscillates between contentment and discontentment. We don't see the truth that it is all suffering, or all dukkha. We also don't see the cause of suffering clearly, the second of the noble truths. The cause is desire, or craving. Those with the most superficial understanding will think that they suffer when they don't get what they desire. When they get what they want, they're happy. Meditators may understand a little deeper and see that they suffer whenever desire arises. This is still a relatively shallow understanding. When we clearly see the truth, the true Dhamma, we see that the body and mind are nothing but masses of suffering in themselves. However, when desire for happiness or freedom from suffering arises, the mind struggles and thus adds an extra dose of suffering on top of the heap of suffering that there already is. It is endless. The third noble truth, the end or cessation of suffering, is another thing that is often wrongly understood as death, or a place we go to when we die. The truth of cessation is the liberation from suffering while we are alive. The body and mind are still suffering and changing about, but there is no attachment to these things. In enlightenment, when the body dies, it is not a liberation from suffering that still exists, but it is a complete extinction of suffering. The fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path to the End of Suffering, is also hard to understand. The Eightfold Path includes right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. People think that these are eight different stages along a path, but actually the path is like a spider with eight legs. Each leg makes up the path, but is not the path. If we have mindfulness, all eight factors that make up the path will develop appropriately. When we have mindfulness, then we will see things in the right way. We will think, speak, act, and work rightly. We will have the right effort, as the mind will develop in wholesomeness and be guarded against unwholesomeness. And right mindfulness will lead to right concentration, characterized by a mind that is neutral and stable, not attached to the phenomena that arise. So our duty is to practice in the foundations of mindfulness, to study the body and mind. Please keep observing them, and keep learning, and reality will be revealed.